State of the Bay. I'm Fred Pitts, filling in for Grace Wan and Ethan Elkind. Later on in the hour, we'll explore the impact of the abrupt cancellation of federal funding on local arts organizations. Then, author Gary Crist will discuss his new book, Trespassers at the Golden Gate, a true account of love, murder, and madness in Gilded Age San Francisco. But first, the recall effort to recall Sunset supervisor Joel Engardio took an odd turn last week when the leader of the recall effort, Vin Budai, abruptly stepped down. With 10,000 signatures needed by the May 22nd deadline, what is the signal for the recall effort and Engardio's future? Here to help us understand all this and what's happening is Han Lee, politics reporter from the San Francisco Standard. Han Lee, welcome to State of the Bay.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. So, okay, first of all, who is Vin Budai?
So Vin is a founder of this recall campaign, and he has been very active at the Gray Highway controversy since a couple of years ago when there was a ballot measure about whether to reopen it, right? And since last year, we all know the Proposition K, which is a very controversial ballot measure to close down the Gray Highway and make it into a park. Vin Budai was a leader in that movement too, and this recall campaign, he was also a founder of it.
Now, have you heard anything about what prompted Budai's abrupt resignation?
Yeah, so I did talk to different parties in this controversy about this issue. So as far as what I know from different sources, they have some disagreement of how to spend money in the final days of the recall campaign, right? As we know, the recall campaign has, I think, two, three more days. They have to submit signatures by Thursday to the Department of Election. So there are some disagreement about, you know, whether they will double down or, you know, maybe spend more money to hire more signature gatherers, right? Mm-hmm. And then it might get the recall campaign into debt. That's why they're having some disagreement. That's why he quit.
Interesting. And why was District 4 Supervisor Joel Engardio being recalled in the first place?
Oh, yeah. So that's a really good question, right? So as we know, last year we had that Proposition K, which closed down the Gray Highway, and the Gray Highway is located in the west side of the city, right? And frequently used by some of the west side drivers. But because of Prop K, and it's passed by the citywide voter to close that down, some of the West Side voters are very upset because, you know, they use that road. And also some of them feel like it's a regional issue. It shouldn't be decided by citywide voters, right? So some of the Sunset residents initialized this recall campaign against Sunset Supervisor Joel Engardio because he was one of the leader of Prop K. And also he represents that area that a lot of their residents have feel bypassed and disrespected.
Do you know if during this whole process there were like town halls or meetings with residents of the area with Joel Engardio?
I think before they announced that, there was maybe very limited community engagement. But after that, the whole Proposition K was, you know, very widely debated. So there's very a lot of passion and discussion around it, but still, it still remains highly controversial. I think on the west side, about 64% voters voted against it, but citywide, it's supported by a lot of urbanists, bicyclists, and environmentalists, right? So it's supported by the citywide voters. About 55% voted supporting it.
Do you think this is why this whole issue is so charged right now?
You mean the division between the driver and the...
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so I think that's a very interesting observation, because when we talk about San Francisco politics, right, we always say progressive or moderate, but there is like a new division dividing the city politics right now, which, you know, it's defined by urbanists and bicyclists versus the more traditional suburban lifestyle driver, and also people would have concerns on housing densities, right? What we call NIMBY too.
Okay. Now, District 1 Supervisor Connie Chan, who represents the Inner Richmond, has said that she will introduce a ballot measure to reopen the Great Highway to cars if Engardio gets recalled. So why is Connie Chan championing this?
Yeah, so Connie Chan, supervisor of the District 1, which is the Richmond District, she has been very outspoken on this issue. against Proposition K and the closure of the Gray Highway, right? So she said in her blog post a couple of weeks ago that if there is opportunity, she would seek to reopen the Gray Highway through another ballot measure. And, you know, that's like a very political statement, right?
Mm-hmm.
For now, when Engadio is facing this recall. But the reality is it will have a lot of things come together to make that happen. So first, you have to have a citywide election, and then you will have enough support on the Board of Supervisors, like supported by another five of her colleagues to put this on the ballot, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know if that's a real thing, but Connie has always been outspoken against the Gray Highway closure.
Okay. Now, your paper, The Standard, polled the people using the newly closed Great Highway, and it seems like it was mostly being used by Sunset residents, many of whom were against the closure in the first place. Is this accurate?
I think it was when the Great Highway is still open to car traffic,
mm-hmm.
it should be used a lot by the West Side driver, including both the Richmond and Sunset resident, and as well as I think Daly City or Marin County people, they used to commute that. But mm-hmm. I don't have like a clear data on that.
Do you know if the residents in the area right now on the West Side are actually using the park as it is?
Oh yeah, I think so. I think they claim the Sunset Dunes, now it's known by Sunset Dunes.
Mm-hmm.
I think they said there are a lot of visitors to the park, and it was the third most popular park in the city.
Interesting. Now, do the people involved with the recall think they're going to have, or do they have enough signatures for the recall itself? And if that does happen, when will the recall occur?
I think we will find out very soon, because they have a deadline this Thursday to submit their signatures, about 10K required a valid signature to qualify. And then I think Department of Election will spend up to 60 days to verify their signatures. And after that, if it qualifies, it will need, the Department of Election will call an special election within 120 days, which is about 4 months. So likely October, I guess, yeah.
Okay. And do you know how Engadio is handling the recall effort presently?
I think he has a very strong campaign team, and I think his message now is telling the voters not to sign their signatures to support a recall. And of course, right, recalling him will not overturn the Gray Highway. And also, I think their main message right now is the park will become a great space for families, for the city, for the kids to hang out to.
Okay. And how is the transition to the park going? Are people actually using it or not using it?
I think Sunset Dunes, which is the official name of the park.
Yes, Sunset Dunes. Thank you.
Yes. So I think, it, as I just mentioned, it was a very popular destination for visitors during the pandemic. It was the third most visited park, right? But also, people would claim, you know, the West Side, the weather was not always that good. It would be foggy time, it's cold. So sometimes the road will be seen as not as that many people there. So we're waiting for more data, maybe from Rec and Park, to see how many people are actually using it right now. Just like, you know, MTA is also like testing what the traffic change in the area too.
Okay. And is there any word on how traffic has really been impacted because of the creation of Sunset Dunes?
I think we hear here and there, there are, you know, residents complaining about the West Side traffic. And also, I think the Standard published some stories about, oh, yeah, there are some traffic getting worse in the area. But mm-hmm. I think we're also waiting for MTA having an official data on that. Maybe that would take like 3 months. So we are waiting for that one too.
Okay. Do you think Engadio will survive all this?
I think we will see what happened Thursday, right, to see how many people submit their signatures. And then if it qualifies for a recall, a special election, I think he will face a very hard battle. And also, if he survived that, and again, in 2026, there will be a re-election campaign, right? So that will also be a hard battle for him.
Okay. Is Engadio's term almost up? How much time does he have left in his term?
He will have re-election in 26 November.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And how much does a recall usually cost the city?
Oh, that's a really good question. So, you know, we have two very high profile recall in 2022, but those are citywide recall. Mm-hmm. So, and also, I think the school board recall is sort of like a special election merged with like another one. But the June recall was together with like a primary election. But this time it will be like a special election in only District 4, the Sunset District. So it might cost a little bit less, but also it's like a single independent election for this own district. So I think that's like an extra cost for the city too.
Okay. And currently, it seems like the west side of the city is feeling a little bit raw right now. I mean, some of the residents who are angry about the Great Highway permanently being closed, now the west side residents are being targeted for new, denser zoning or upzoning. Do you anticipate there being any bigger impacts from their frustration?
Yeah, so this is what I just mentioned, right? So the new division in local politics now is no longer progressive and moderate. It's about, you know, how they live their life in the city, right? Transportation, housing density, right? So yes, I think the upzoning will also become like a controversial part, just like how they handle the Great Highway controversy.
Okay. Well, I think we'll have to leave it there. I would like to thank Han Lee, reporter for politics from The Standard, for joining us tonight. Han, thank you very much for joining State of the Bay.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk to local arts organizations about the impact of the abrupt cancellation of their federal grants. That's right after the break. Stay with us.
This week on This American Life, Bellen thinks a huge part of who he is can be traced back to a moment before he was even born, when his dad met this guy named Dave at the Oklahoma City airport. So, one day, Bellen calls Dave.
I would just urge you that if you do write this, that's honoring to your mom and dad. You don't want the devil jumping on them.
The devil he knows, and the devil he doesn't, this week.
Story time for This American Life. Tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock here on 91.7 FM, KLW San Francisco.
In the 1930s, Los Angeles police officers tried turning U.S. citizens away at the California border.
They would try to discourage people who looked like they were very poor from coming into California.
On the next Throughline from NPR, California's border blockade.
Throughline, tomorrow afternoon at 5 o'clock here on 91.7 FM, KLW San Francisco.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Fred Pitts. A few weeks ago, an assortment of Bay Area arts organizations received letters from the National Endowment of the Arts, or NEA, canceling promised funds, citing a new list of priorities, if you want to call them that, that will be used to award grants going forward. 20 local arts organizations have had their funding completely canceled. Many others are on notice. What is the impact on arts in the Bay? We want you to be part of this important conversation about arts in our communities. Do you work in an arts organization and want to share what this moment feels like for you? Are you an artist whose livelihood is at risk? What do the arts mean to you? Give us a call. We're at 866-798-8255. That is 866-798-8255. Find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay, one word, at klw.org. Here to help us make sense, of all this new landscape is the arts director of, I will call him the founding artist director of New Conservatory Theater, Ed Decker. Ed, welcome to State of the Bay. And correct me if I completely butchered your title, because I know you and you can correct me if you'd like.
Thank you. Thank you, Fred. I'm the founding artistic director.
Thank you, Ed. And Julie Ruliak Steinberg, executive director of Community Music Center. Welcome, Julie.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure having both of you here. Okay, let's get into this. Julie, I will start with you for a little bit of context. How do NEA grants work?
Yeah, so the National Endowment for the Arts was really founded with the intention of helping to create a vibrant society, one that's rooted in exciting cultural opportunities for everyone. And so arts organizations like CMC, Community Music Center, where I'm the director, we apply for these grants with specific projects in mind. In our case, it's a music education grant. And, you know, there are a lot of different requirements around the funding, but really NEA funding is kind of an endorsement of an organization's work, for better or for worse, and has long kind of been considered the gold standard of, you know, if you're funded by the NEA, you're kind of a trustworthy organization. And so I think that's kind of why this feels particularly shocking at this moment for, mm-hmm. for arts organizations.
What were the NEA's priorities for funding until recently, just in general?
Gosh, they had quite a lot, But the, you know, I can speak for CMC, which is, you know, for us, it was about providing totally tuition-free support mm-hmm. for students through two tuition-free programs that were offered year-round, our Mission District Young Musicians Program and our Teen Jazz Orchestra. Mm-hmm. These are programs that serve, you know, historically underrepresented communities, again, are offered totally tuition-free, so barriers to access are removed. And, you know, I think when we find that federal funding is pulled, or you know, really any municipal funding is pulled, it tends to be those who are at the most risk who are harmed by that. And so indeed, I think that's what we're experiencing now.
Okay. Ed, let's talk about the stated new priorities for grants. And by the way, listeners, if you want to see the list of these new priorities, you can go to State of the Bay webpage at kalw.org. Ed, some of these new priorities don't seem very arts-oriented at all, like fostering skilled trade jobs or supporting the economic development of Asian communities. I mean, these are fine agendas on the face of it, but what do you make of them being the new funding priorities for the NEA?
Well, they are very much, those new priorities are very much designed to, you know, veer us away from, you know, the freedom of artistic expression. Mm-hmm. As you say, that list of, I don't have it in front of me, but that list of priorities does not, you know, connect with the arts making community as far as I can see nationwide. So I feel as though the current administration is making a very strong statement about limiting and curtailing freedom of expression, right, which is a very, very dangerous road to be on.
Right. Just for our listeners' sake, I actually had the list of new priorities in front of me. I'm just going to read it off. Elevate the nation's HBCUs, or historically Black colleges and universities, and Hispanic-serving institutions. Celebrate the 250th anniversary of American independence. Foster AI competency. Empower houses of worship to serve communities. Assist with disaster recovery. Foster skilled job trades. Make America healthy again. Support the military and veterans. Support tribal communities. Make the District of Columbia safe and beautiful. Support the economic development of Asian American communities. Julie, this question is for you, and I'm not sure if you know the answer to this, but do you know if these new priorities are part of what's called the America 250 initiative? I mean, do you know what that is, and can you explain it?
I don't know that I can explain the full initiative, but I can say that the America 250 initiative was part of prior NEA sort of opportunities for funding, particularly for works of art created to celebrate the anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. I think, though, when you look at these priorities and you think about, you know, do the arts have economic impacts for certain groups? Of course they do. Mm-hmm. Are there ways that the arts can influence these ideas? Without a doubt. But I think when you see them together as a whole, what's really clear is that the NEA and its founding priorities, again, around creating vibrant communities, all of the supports that come with that, artistic freedom, mm-hmm. these are not going to be a priority of the administration. And if anything, I think it's kind of a sad, you know, it's pointing to a sad time when this agency won't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm. And that's the worry, is that the current administration is trying to just remove the NEA completely. Ed, question for you. For a group of people who are very against DEI and very against what seems like advantaging specific ethnic groups in any way, I wonder what the feeling is of why singling out a particular group. I mean, the whole thing is confusing. Again, just to be clear, economic development is a fine goal for a government to have, but in looking at this list and some of the funding that's been withdrawn, it seems like there's a very specific and narrow agenda that's being pushed forward.
Exactly. And of course, the list that of priorities that you read in and of themselves are fine opportunities to be working towards, but they are not necessarily NEA opportunities or opportunities for inclusive and diverse artistic expression. And you're right that it's meant to curtail all of that. And to your earlier point about what does this mean in the bigger sense for the NEA? I think that most of us out here are very concerned about the approach the administration is taking by rescinding these funds for, I think, somewhere nationwide, I think that the total is up to somewhere around above $10 million worth of money has been rescinded from arts organizations. And it really feels as though it's going the way with some of the other administration's tactics in terms of trying to sort of hollow out these institutions like the Department of Education, for example, but we won't go there right now, so that the infrastructure within the NEA would eventually collapse because it is not able to sort of fulfill the goals that it is meant to fulfill. By imposing all of these restrictions on art making.
Okay. We've got a caller in from Oakland. Rebecca, you are on the air.
Hi. Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you? Thanks for calling in.
No problem.
You have a question?
Yeah, I'm just curious to hear more of your thoughts about the NEA. Run a nonprofit dance organization based in San Francisco, and we are among a group of collective artists who are trying to think about what to do next in light of the NEA's partial dissolution and how we're going to leverage the lack of the NEA to raise more funds, potentially support our work.
All right. Juliet, any thoughts on what you all are thinking of doing to try to address the NEA issues here?
Yeah. I think, one of the things that we can do is just to absolutely stand strong together. I think so often arts organizations are asked to do more with less, and we can see one another as competition, right? And I think at this moment, it is so, so important for us to collectively raise our voices, to find our peer organizations, to align with them and to talk about the, I think another thing that's going to come out of all of this is our need to just continue with our storytelling to make sure that we are consistently making the value of our work known, even though we all experience it and know how it feels, making the value of our work known and our collective impact together, whether that's economic, whether that's, jobs creation, mental health supports, as well as creating extraordinary art for people to enjoy. Mm-hmm. I think doing that collectively and without fear is one of the most important steps we can take.
I agree. Ed, how unusual is it for a grant like this to be canceled? I mean, is it even legal for an administration to change the NEA's priorities like this, in your experience?
Well, I get the legal question is a big one, and I'm sure there's going to be more down the road on that, on that particular question. Mm-hmm. The sort of abrupt withdrawal of funds is rare. I mean, there are situations where funding priorities shift in grant making organizations, but there is usually a conversation with the community, about that, and there's some warning ahead of time that that it's headed our way. This was, for so many of us, very alarming and surprising. In our case, we were already well into the production and run of the world premiere of Simple Mexican Pleasures, which our NEA grant was meant to support. And like other organizations, we had to find a way in which to, you know, keep that moving forward without those funds being available to us. You know, after all the actors and creative team members have already been engaged, mm-hmm. and the show is up and running. And I think, you know, in piggybacking on the last question and everything that Julie said, I'm in complete agreement with, and add the dimension of, you know, co-opting our audiences in this conversation as well to help us amplify our collective voices and make sure that we, you know, send the message that the arts is a very, very important dynamic and activity in our society. And so filling our houses, and like I said, using our collective voice to make sure that we let our leaders know that this is not acceptable.
This is State of the Bay on local radio 91.7 KALW Bay Area. I'm Fred Pitts. We're discussing the abrupt cancellation of promised NEA grants to local arts organizations. Have these cancellations prompted you to show support for an arts organization you care about? Do you think arts organizations should change their language to stay under the radar of the Trump administration? You can join us by calling in 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, or email us at stateofthebay, one word, at kalw.org. Continuing on, Julie, so describe what the community center is, what it does. I mean, I think you talked about it in the beginning, but just specifically, what specific programs were cut or had to be cut because of these removal of these grants, I guess is the best way to put it.
Sure. So again, we're a 103-year-old nonprofit. We're based in San Francisco, but work citywide. And we have about 3,400 students of all ages, all backgrounds, abilities who study with us every year. Mm-hmm. More than 70% of those students receive some kind of tuition assistance or attend for free. So we've got very, very beginner students to very advanced musicians who are playing out and, you know, pursuing professional paths. So the programs that were affected related to our NEA grant, first was our Teen Jazz Orchestra, which is celebrating its 30th anniversary next year. It is led by the extraordinary Marcus Shelby. It meets for the full school year, again, totally tuition free. And these students of various levels, experience come together, are supported by Marcus and by CMC's infrastructure, and ultimately also play out. You know, they get the opportunity not just to learn in the classroom, but also to bring that joy out to the community. Just played the Half Moon Bay Art and Wine Festival. So that's a really important program for us. The other program that was affected is our Mission District Young Musicians Program, led by five extraordinary teaching artists. And MDYMP focuses on preservation of Latin music and Latin culture. You can see our MDYMP students at Carnaval next weekend in the parade, mm-hmm. as well as on the main stage. And these students are just extraordinary. They receive year-round private lessons as well as immersive classes, and they give back to their community as well. So, you know, we have received funding for these programs for, you know, 15 or so years. And at this point, you know, we are committed to seeing them go forward. We have had our community step up, but again, kind of can't help but notice that the choice making here is around programs that are serving youth, serving historically underrepresented youth, and that are talking about preserving cultural traditions that likely don't align with the administration's priorities.
I would agree with that. And I can say I've actually listened to that youth organization, The Mission, for years because I live in the Mission District, so I've heard them at Carnival pretty much every year. Why do we think that youth programming is so important? Why do we feel that?
I think youth programming has a couple of just extraordinary benefits. I mean, first of all, youth are able to often find their voice mm-hmm. in a classroom, right? It takes a lot of bravery, a lot of tenacity to come back week after week as you're learning this instrument, feeling unfamiliar on it. and slowly starting to find those benchmarks that are shown to you by extraordinary mentors and teachers. CMC's teaching artists are extraordinary, and they are also very often of the culture that they are teaching in, are extraordinary performers, and they bring so much to the classroom. And I think, you know, particularly in programs like this where students are playing in ensembles, right, they're forming bonds, they're forming friendships, they're feeling safe with one another, and they check on one another. Mm-hmm. And I think this kind of social emotional support, you know, we've seen just time and time again through research and through, you know, just experiences that are shared with us by parents and students, how important they are, and they're worthy of support.
Ed, I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, that today is an important day for the new Conservatory Theater. Can you share why today's so important?
Thank you. Yes. Well, we can't hold a candle to Julie's 103, but today NCTC is celebrating its 44th birthday.
Congratulations.
Oh, happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you.
And describe for us what New Conservatory Theater does. I've actually done a show there, so I know the theater company very well, but describe for our audience what your mission is.
Well, a couple of things. When I founded the company in 1981, it was focused on being a progressive arts education program for young people. Mm-hmm. And then we moved into our theater facility at 25 Van Ness, and suddenly had three theaters to work with, and we branched out to including work making theater for the queer and allied community. So the youth programs are still very much the beating heart of NCTC, and we produce a variety of stories from, like I said, the queer and allied community, opening up the conversation to different cultural heritages, identity and discovery and unity and belonging, mm-hmm. you know, in short, highlighting the multiplicity of our shared humanity. And that is really a core ingredient in the arts as a collaborative endeavor, bringing people together from all walks of life, all ages, to, you know, make and or view work together.
I'm going to invite on to the air Danielle Brazel. She's the executive director of the California Arts Council. Danielle, you're on. Can you hear me?
Hey.
I can hear you fine. Thanks for joining the show. Let me ask you, how is the CAC being impacted by these new priorities from the current administration?
We're not sure. We have not yet received our partnership agreement. So for you and the rest of your listeners, the California Arts Council is your state-designated arts agency. Mm-hmm. And the National Endowment for the Arts, when it was founded, it made a commitment to redirect a portion of their annual appropriation directly to state arts councils to re-grant and to provide some baseline operating support for the agencies. And that sparked an extraordinary growth of state arts agencies around the country. Mm-hmm. The California Arts Council has, for close to 50 years, we've been that state arts agency. And we understand that the National Council on the Arts did review and approve those state partnership agreements, but we have not yet received any information about the grant award or its terms.
Okay. Are there specific things that you're telling particular California arts organization right now that you support?
That we support? Well,
yeah. Is there a message you have for them now? Or?
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think that first and foremost, the cancellation and termination of existing grant awards from the National Endowment of the Arts to nonprofit arts organizations across the country is going to put that entire ecosystem at risk. I mean, we nonprofit arts and cultural organizations are constantly having to raise a one-to-one match on that NEA award. So federal dollars and state dollars are all leveraging tools for local nonprofits, and they then leverage additional dollars from state and local entities, which are also being threatened with local cuts at the moment. And then they raise the additional money through private donations, philanthropy, et cetera. So if you lose out on that critical matching dollar, that's going to impact every single organization that received a federal award.
Okay. Let me go back to Ed and Julie Weather here. Just a question for you guys. Are you seeing local donors in your community filling the gaps for funds? Are there other grants that are at risk from pressure from the federal government that you know of?
I can say that CMC's community has been extraordinary. Time and again, you know, we know that community takes care of one another, and we've really seen our donors, you know, from our small dollar donors all the way up to our larger dollar donors, wanting to step in and be activated, to raise their voices, to call their representatives, to speak out. So we've been really lucky in that way. Also from a field perspective, you know, we understand that we're seeing philanthropy wanting to, I mean, obviously I think there's some concern about, you know, private philanthropy being able to fulfill, you know, the largesse of the federal government, but seeing them, right, increase their number of awards they'll give out each year, or the amount of awards they'll give out each year. And I hope that we'll continue to see that and to see it more substantially.
Okay. And Ed, do you know if there's an appeal process for these cancellations? Is it worth trying to appeal for this?
There is an appeal process. It was a very short window. We had 7 days from the email that we had received last month to submit an appeal. And NEA NCTC did submit an appeal, and we have not heard anything anything back from them. And in the meantime, as Julie was saying, you know, we're very blessed that our community has gathered and stepping forward to, you know, help out. But in the long term, this you know, adds additional strain to what's already difficult for nonprofit arts organizations. We were very, very resourceful and able to stretch a dollar, but we keep seeing more and more things sort of pulled back from the arts and from education, and having to find even more ways to fill in those gaps. It's a challenge.
Yeah. Now, clearly this administration doesn't like any language that hints at anything DEI related. Have you been tempted to remove such language or change language from either your literature or your mission statement, or just keep doing the work that is true to your values?
Oh, absolutely not. That is not even on the table for conversation for us at NCTC. Mm-hmm. It's very, very important to uphold the integrity of the voices that we represent, and not to cower and back away at this moment. So no, full steam ahead.
And Julie, how about CMC?
We feel the same. You know, CMC has, you know, first of all, I really try hard not to use the DEI or, you know, I mean, I want to just say the words, which are diversity, inclusion, equity, belonging. These are founding principles for Community Music Center. Our work has been centered around them for 103 years. We also know that diversity and inclusion is what makes our program so phenomenal. And so, no, we have no plans to change any of the language that we are using. We're very proud of the work we do in our community, and we will stand strong.
A couple of quotes that we got from some other arts directors who emailed into KALW, one of which was from Emily Cleon of the San Francisco Youth Theater, who wrote that she feared that this is just the beginning of an assault on our cultural life and expression. The arts shine a light on the truth, and that's the last thing this administration wants. There's another quote that I liked from Richard Aldag, who's the executive director of the San Francisco Contemporary Music Players, who wrote, "These cancellations and new priorities," in quotes, "reflect a disdain for the arts as a forum of open expression of ideas," which I actually agree with. For both of you, what is next for your organizations, and how will this change how you do business going forward, if it changes things at all? Julie, I'll start with you.
Sure. I just want to echo something that Ed said earlier, which is, you know, we are very resourceful and, you know, we are able to often innovate and come up with new ways to serve folks and reach communities. But these things have a limit, right? And ultimately, I fear that organizations are going to be put in really tough choice making positions. And again, you know, from our perspective, CMC is in a moment of contemplation. We're creating our next strategic plan after having just completed a large organizational expansion. And for us, we're really thinking about how to ensure we can continue to reach the communities that we serve and to do it in a way that's sustainable and to be able to partner even more effectively. And I think if there's one thing we're taking away from all of this, it's that being partners with other arts organizations, with the city, with our neighbors, and not allowing our voices to be silenced, not allowing our freedom of expression to be withheld, is going to be a primary piece of our work going forward. And to keep the music playing. I mean, at the end of the day, we want to find that joy in what we do.
Ed, kind of quickly, what's next for NCTC? Same question.
Well, I think building again on what Julie is saying, all of the above, and I think it's very, very important that we turn up the volume on our conversation of resistance and demonstrate our ability to continue to make art in all of its forms that represents the strength of not only our local community, but also the diversity and inclusion of nationally as well. This is what makes America strong and innovative. And so I believe that for NCTC, the conversations will move along these lines and continue to be forward thinking.
Okay. Last thing we have this evening is we have one caller who's been very patient online. His name is Mike from San Francisco. Mike, we've got a little less than a minute. We'd like to take your call. Welcome to the show.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. I love the show. Yeah, look, I mean, I did not vote for the current president. My issue is with art. I live in the Castro district. Okay, the Castro Theater shut down. Why? I mean, I don't know. How long did it take? 10 years for them to fix that? I mean, Pablo Picasso never had money, right? He would just walk into restaurants and draw something on a napkin. Andy Warhol was an artist. I mean, I don't see what. Basically, my question is this: why does the government? Why should the government have anything to do with art? Okay. I mean, it's kind of, I mean, they should support students and schools in art programs, but I just don't.
I understand your point of view. I understand your perspective. Thank you for calling.
All these nonprofits, is like if the art is not selling, then maybe the art's not profitable. So just cancel it.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to cut all this short because we're about out of time at this time. Well, listeners, if you value the arts and the role in our society, now is the time to show your support for the local arts organizations. And I want to thank everyone who sent comments and called in and sent questions. Unfortunately, we have to leave it there. So I would like to thank Ed Decker of the New Conservatory Theater and Julie Ruliak of the Community Music Center. Thank you both for being on the show tonight. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Fred.
Coming up after the break, you'll hear my interview with author Gary Crist about his new book, Trespassers at the Golden Gate, a true account of love, murder, and madness in Gilded Age San Francisco. We'll be right back.
Join us for Your Legal Rights Wednesday evenings at 6. Host Jeff Hayden and guests cover a wide variety of legal topics and issues, from tax tips to landlord-tenant issues, discrimination and workers' rights on the job, as well as broader constitutional issues. That's Your Legal Rights every Wednesday evening at 6, here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area, and online at kalw.org.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Fred Pitts. Today we interview Gary Crist, best-selling author of Trespassers at the Golden Gate. Through meticulous research of a murder trial, Crist paints a picture of Gold Rush San Francisco as an unruly boontown, the kind of place where a jealous woman killed her married lover. Gary Crist, welcome to State of the Bay.
Very happy to be here.
Well, we are glad to have you. So, Gary, if you would, give us just a small description or summary of the crime involved in this book.
Well, on one level, the book is really a classic true crime narrative about one of the most sensational murders in San Francisco history. It's November of 1870, and this young, beautiful, already somewhat notorious woman, Laura D. Fair, guns down her longtime adulterous lover, A.P. Crittenden, on a crowded ferry going from Oakland to San Francisco. And she does it right in front of the victim's wife and children. So the crime itself was really just about as brazen and scandalous as it could get. And the victim was a fairly well-known San Francisco attorney and California politician. So you knew it was going to get a certain amount of feverish attention, at least locally and regionally. But as I said, it ultimately blew up into a national sensation.
It's a really interesting book, and I really enjoyed reading it. Why is this case important?
Well, for several reasons. First of all, it was one of the first trials in American legal history to involve a temporary insanity defense, which was very controversial at the time. But the case really touched on a number of hot-button social issues at the time, issues that really challenged traditional thinking about things like the proper place of women in the public sphere, if any, the sanctity of marriage and the family, what you might call the range of acceptable expressions of femininity. Mm-hmm. But I mean, if you're a respectable woman, there are certain things you can do, certain things you can't do if you want to remain respectable. And all of this was very much in contention, very much in flux in the years after the Civil War. If you think about it, during the Civil War, a lot of women were forced to perform traditionally male functions because all of their males were off fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them had proven themselves quite capable. And so after the war, they were determined not to go back to the old days of pure subservience and domesticity. They wanted to vote. Mm-hmm. They wanted to own property separate from their husbands. They wanted to be out in the world doing things. And this was seen as a threat, certainly by a lot of men, but also by a lot of conservative women. It was seen as an attack on the basic building block of a stable Victorian society, which is that traditional family where it's the man who's facing the world and the woman's realm is hearth and home.
Yeah, that really came through in the book. Now, your research for this book is, I would use the word extensive, which is good. It's like 60-odd pages of notes and bibliography. And I read that you did not add a single word of dialogue that you cannot cite. Now, did that kind of detail derail some of your ideas for the book?
Well, it governs my choice of the story that I'm going to tell, because a story can be wonderfully dramatic, as this one is, on the surface. But if you don't have the source material to really bring that to life, supported by the historical record, then you can't do the idea, no matter what it is. So fortunately, I had probably the richest supply of source material in this book than I've ever had in any other book in my career.
Wow. What did you enjoy most about the research?
Well, coming to San Francisco, certainly. But I love dealing with archivists and the people who are the caretakers of the historical record, because I find that almost all of them are very eager to work with writers and get this information out there, because history is something we lose every day, I think.
I am in full agreement of that. Now, in this book, you thread through this murder story, the social realities of life in what's really boomtown San Francisco, and the ever-changing rights and attitudes for different marginalized groups. Was it difficult to balance the plot of the case with all this social context?
Well, a lot of those stories I tell, I think, underline the basic theme of the trial, which is these, what I call the trespassers. These are mostly women, Blacks, Chinese, cross-dressing people who are not fitting into the Victorian categories of respectability. And the thesis of the book is that in the early years of the Gold Rush, when everybody was concerned with making money, they weren't standing on ceremony, these people had an easier time. But then as the city matured, as more middle-class families moved in, the sort of strictures of Victorian society began to be enforced much more rigidly. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of these people had a lot more trouble in the 1860s than they had in the 40s and 50s.
And that makes sense. That was the case in a lot of the bigger cities. What really surprised you the most with all this research you did for this book?
I was really most surprised by the extent to which the Southern diaspora really was in control in the state of California in the early years.
And that surprised me as well.
Yeah, I mean, particularly in the military and in a state government. And when the war started, there was some real worry that California was going to secede from the Union and either join the Confederacy or, more likely, establish itself along with Oregon as something called the Pacific Republic. And all of this was led by displaced Southerners.
Interesting. There are a lot of characters in this book that we all know very well. Mark Twain, Mary Ellen Pheasant, Susan B. Anthony, among some others that had what I would call significant cameos in the book. How did you choose who to include and who not to include?
There's always difficulty trying to decide what to leave out of a book like this. I try to paint a broad canvas, which is why I can bring in people like Mark Twain and Susan B. Anthony. But they all really were commenting on this case because it was a big media circus when it finally hit. So, you know, Mark Twain actually used the Laura Fair story as the basis of one of the subplots of his first novel, The Gilded Age.
I don't think I knew that. Wow.
Yeah. And Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton actually came out to San Francisco when Laura Fair was in prison, and they interviewed with her. And they thought that she was being unfairly treated. And that night, Susan B. Anthony gave a speech in San Francisco, and she was almost booed off the stage because she was defending Laura Fair.
Yeah.
To a certain extent, it was easy because a lot of these people were drawn to this case.
Okay. And can you tell us a little bit about Mark Twain and Bret Hart?
Well, one of the things I cover in the book is what I consider really the first San Francisco literary golden age. And that came about in the 60s when two major figures, Bret Hart and Mark Twain, were both in town at the same time. And I really think that together they established a new, distinctly Western voice in American literature. It was irreverent, it was very funny, and it was full of vitality. And so one of the things I argue in the book is that together, these two very different writers managed to pull the center of gravity of American letters a little bit to the West.
Now, I know this is not your first book, and actually, I have read your other book, City of Scoundrels, because I spent years in Chicago, so I know all about the summer of 1919. You are an accomplished novelist, a short story writer, and as I mentioned about your history book with Chicago, you've written 5 nonfiction books, often delving into the history of a particular city, Chicago, New Orleans, LA, and now San Francisco. What do you like about writing fiction versus nonfiction?
I actually think that I get the same pleasures from writing both because I'm doing more or less the same thing in both, trying to shape a storyline, bring out character, underline certain themes. The only thing is with the nonfiction, you can't make it up. So on the one hand, you don't face that daily existential crisis that fiction writers face of the empty page. It's not there unless it comes out of my head. But I also, since I can't make things up, if it's not in the historical record, I can't do it. So they really present different challenges, but I do enjoy doing both.
Do you have any other projects that are cooking? Any new projects you can talk about?
Well, I may have one more city book in me, and I spent most of my life in and around New York, and they've always said, why don't you write something about New York? I may do that, but that's still very tentative at this point.
Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure, and we're just about out of time for this interview, but readers out there, if you'd like to read a fascinating book about a section of San Francisco history, please read Trespassers at the Golden Gate by Gary Crist. It really is a must read for really any history buff. Gary, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it's a pleasure being here.
I'm Fred Pitts, and this is State of the Bay. Well, that's State of the Bay for this week. We'll hope you'll join us next Monday at 6 when we'll talk to wildland firefighter and anthropologist Jordan Thomas about his new book, When It All Burns. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen and never miss an episode.
For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit State of the Bay page on kalw.org. If you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. Email us at any time at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb and Heather Hughes. It was engineered by David Kwan, and Damian Miner was our board operator. Up next, a rebroadcast of today's Your Call with Ethan Elkind. I'm Fred Pitts. Good night, and thanks for listening.